to Spark Your Fire podcast. Content discussed on this podcast is general in nature. Please seek specific advice from qualified professionals. Now, let's start with the quote of the week.
There's no losing, only learning. There's no failure, only opportunities. And there's no problems, only solutions.
G'day everyone, welcome back to the show. It's Jazz here. Along with me is John, and we are here to do our weekly wrap. David is running a little bit late, so he'll be joining us very soon as well. John, happy Friday.
Happy Friday as always, Jazz. Yeah, good to be here. You're somewhere in the Twilight Zone, I can see from your background. And lucky you, maybe you've joined NASA and touched down on Mars or something.
That's it, mate. Earth is too crowded for me. Yeah. I want to live somewhere in peace. John, every week we try and cover a lot of stuff. This week we have got two of the topics that have been trending in the market as well. I thought maybe the first one to get started was, obviously the market's pretty hot, doesn't matter which asset class you look at, and we did discuss that over the last couple of weeks in our weekly wraps. Do you want to maybe touch on, for listeners or investors out there, on how to spot a bubble? What are some of the key indicators or trends to look at? We'll take it from there after that.
We'll do the news of the week after that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, look, it's something we touched on last week, isn't it? That people are looking at the economy in the wrong way. Everyone's looking at the stock market, and we're looking at the real estate market, but they're really just symptoms of what really are driving things. And insiders on Wall Street actually don't look at those things as primary drivers. They look at them as the result of the economy. There are three things that people ought to be looking at as indicators for the overall health of the economy, and as indicators for whether or not there's a bubble or whether or not there's about to be a burst. And these three things are the 10-year treasury, the treasury yield, the oil price, and the gold price. You can look at those three indicators and you'll know everything you need to know. Okay. So shall I go into each one really quickly?
Yeah, sure. Let's start with the treasury yield, especially the 10-year one has been going up a little bit. So let's start with that.
Yeah. So the 10-year treasury note is the world's tier one asset. It took over from gold after we went off the gold standard. So it is the world's reserve asset, right? So the 10-year treasury is the world's reserve asset. Now, the way to think about it is that everything on the planet is a derivative of the debt market. Everything is a derivative of the debt market. The stock market's a derivative of the debt market. The real estate market's a derivative of the debt market. The crypto market, if people are borrowing to get into that, the crypto market's a derivative of the debt market. Everything's a derivative of the debt market. And our currencies aren't hard assets anymore. They're debt-based fiat. So they're also derivatives of the 10-year treasury. So you can look at that one indicator and know everything you need to know. So firstly, like, it's a hurdle rate. So if you look at real estate and we say, why is real estate going up? And the reason real estate's going up is because if the 10-year treasury yield is 1.4%, let's say, it went down to 0.5%, real estate needs to go up maybe double from here so that the yield on an investment property is equal to about 1.5%, which is the yield on a treasury note. So how do we know that real estate's not currently overvalued? Because the yield is way higher than the 10-year treasury, right? So it tells you all that stuff. The other thing is that when yields are going up, it means they're selling treasuries. So the question is, well, where are people putting their money if they're taking money out of the treasury market? So remember, the treasury market's bigger than all the other markets put together. And it tells you it's probably going into the stock market. It could be going into emerging markets. But rising yields means that the bond market's being sold down. So it's telling you that people are having a different perception of risk. It's risk on, risk off. Generally speaking, if you look at the last couple of months, the 10-year treasury yield has been rising slowly. And that money has been coming out of the treasury market into generally the stock market. So early this week, new all-time high in the stock market. But last night, but here's the thing, right? When the 10-year treasury yield starts moving erratically, and uncontrollably, it kind of suggests that the Fed has temporarily lost control of the debt market. Mm-hmm. And that's when things start to crash. So you could have a down day on the Dow. Let's say the Dow goes down by 300 points, but the Treasury market didn't do anything. You go, okay, it's just a down day on the, it's just people taking some profits. It's just a down day. Mm-hmm. If like today, there's a down day on the markets, it's, we're down about 500 points, but the Treasury, the 10-year Treasury spiked uncontrollably, you know, something else is happening and it might be the beginning of a more substantial correction. Mm-hmm. So look at the 10-year Treasury. It tells you a lot of things that you need to know, but it also tells you whether the crashes mm-hmm. are substantial or if they're just some light profit taking. So for, again, today's a really interesting time to be looking at this because the Treasury, the bond market was in a bit of flux overnight. The Treasury yield spiked and the stock market crashed. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's alarm bells, right? Something could be happening there. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how I look at the Treasury market.
Two questions on that before we jump into the oil and gold as the other two indicators. One, Treasury yields in the past were not really that heavily suppressed or manipulated by the Fed Reserve, right? But these days, the yield curve, so-called yield curve control, every time we see markets going, doing crazy stuff, we see Fed jumping in and trying to control the yield curve to bring the markets back to normal. So that's one thing. And because of that, is it really a good indicator anymore? In the past, it surely was. The question is, in the future, is it still really that good of an indicator when it's being manipulated on a regular basis?
Yeah, I think it's still a very good indicator. I'll give you an example. Mm-hmm. In the first half of 2019, so not that long ago, right, the yield curve inverted, which means that to lend money to the government for 1 year was more expensive than to lend money for 10 years. So you get a higher return over 1 year than over 10 years. But the way a yield curve is supposed to look is interest rates are higher the further out into the future you go. Mm-hmm. Now, an inverted yield curve where interest rates are higher in the short debt than they are in the long debt is a predictor of recessions. Mm-hmm. So back in beginning of 2019, let's say April, May, the bond market was saying there's going to be a recession in the next 12 months. Do you remember that sort of conversation when the yield, mm-hmm. curve, yield curve inverted? Now, what did we have 11 months later? We had a massive recession. Now, you could say that the recession came from the lockdown, mm-hmm. but maybe it was already baked into the cake and the lockdown was... Mm-hmm. So I think that it's as relevant as ever. I think it's as relevant as ever. There's another aspect to your question, though, because if you say that the 10-year yield is 1.5%, let's say, mm-hmm. what sane investor would lend to the US government for 10 years to get 1.5% back per annum? It's absolutely nuts. So they're actually, the interesting thing about it is there aren't any private investors buying treasuries and bonds. It's all the Fed. Mm-hmm. So the 10-year treasury yield is telling you whether the Fed's got it all under control or whether they're losing the battle with the private sector.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's a really good point, actually. You can see that in the markets that the demand for these bonds is decreasing day by day, and it's mainly the Fed is the biggest buyer, that is, of the bond. So that's one indicator. The other two were is oil and gold. Should we start with oil maybe first?
Yeah. So oil is kind of underloved at the moment because it's, it's a dirty fuel and all that sort of stuff. But oil is the lifeblood of the economy. So it's absolutely essential. Mm-hmm. Oil is necessary in everything we do. And it tells us if we're growing or not. I'll give you an example. In China, we're not necessarily all that trustful of the data, the GDP growth data that comes out of China. But what people do instead is they say, well, how much energy is being consumed in China? And we'll use that as a proxy for economic growth. So whenever you can't trust the data the oil price is telling you whether there's growth or not, whether there's capacity constraints or not. So the oil is telling you where, just how many goods are being moved around, how much consumption there is, how much investment there is. The oil price is the real economy, and it's really, I mean, it's just, it's so essential to our standard of living. But there's one other thing. The oil price is correlated to the banking sector, because the energy sector is essentially like the banks have lent so much into the energy sector that when the powers that be, this is going to sound conspiratorial, but when the powers that be want to prop up the share price of the banks, they usually do it via propping up the oil price. So there might be a red flag event in the Middle East or something like that. You pop up the oil price, you pop up the banking shares.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a really little known but very tight correlation between banking stocks and the oil price. So that's another thing. That's another reason why the oil price is telling you a bunch of things that are very...
And based on where the oil price is currently, along with the treasury yield, we'll jump into gold in a second. We've discussed gold and commodities a lot already on the podcast. But, or maybe let's just jump into gold as well, and then we'll dig down where we are in the current
scenario. Yeah, because oil's interesting. Oil's over $60 now. So it's telling you that there's inflation and supply problems. But gold is a currency. So gold is also telling you whether there's a problem in the monetary system. So there's two things that gold does. One is it's a bit of a fear indicator. So if gold goes up, people are worried. But it also reflects monetary disorder.
Mm-hmm.
So Jerome Powell and the Fed and the Treasury Department, they'll come out and tell us what a wonderful job that they're doing. But if the gold price is going up, it means that the market doesn't believe them. It's kind of a trust in government indicator. And gold went up, I think, about 30% last year.
Correct.
Which is sort of saying that, look, these policies are bonkers, QE and all that sort of stuff. So for all the reassurance that we get that there's no inflation, the market doesn't believe it. And the reason you can see that is through the gold price.
Mm-hmm. Right. So let's drill down a little bit now. So the yields on the 10-year have been going up since last month or so, right? I don't have the chart in front of me, so I don't know exactly what it is. We have seen oil price go up as well. It's back to its 2019 price before pre-COVID kind of thing. And talking about gold is already, we said before, last year it went up by 30%. Since then, it's been hovering around 18. So between 1700 to 2000 sort of price level, with a possibility of shooting higher over the next year or two, which we have discussed as well. So combining the three, where do you think we are currently in the whole situation?
Okay. So I think if you combine them all, it's a red flag, or it's ringing a bell for inflation.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it seems to be telling me. So if you're an equity investor or a stock or a real estate investor and you like inflation, these indicators tend to be saying that there's inflation. There's also a little bit of a flight from currencies, from national currencies. So the Treasury is telling us a little bit that the US dollar's coming under pressure. Where is that going? It's going into emerging markets and going into commodity currencies like the Australian dollar. It's inflation. But I also think we're at the beginning of an inflation run that's going to last a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at say the oil chart, the chart for oil is very bullish. So we're already up at about $62. Does it get to 100? I mean, I don't know, but the last time it was at 100 was, I think, about 15 years ago, and things were going a bit topsy-turvy then. So inflation is definitely the key message from those key indicators.
Right. Okay. Interesting. Inflation, definitely. This leads into my next topic, which we have been discussing a little bit over the chat. There was an article out this week which talked about Michael Burry predicting that we are headed towards the path of hyperinflation, Weimar-style hyperinflation. How would you know that we are headed into the Weimar hyperinflation based on what's going on in the market? Is it those three things, or there's more to it? And why Michael Burry is betting so heavily on the US headed towards a hyperinflation?
So those three indicators, again, they tell you almost everything you need to know. What Michael Burry said was, you know, he sort of said, because he's the guy from The Big Short who picked the housing market crash. And we've chatted about him a couple of times on this podcast. And he's very, very, very clever, eccentric guy, is the character played by Christian Bale. And he put a chart up of 1914 to 1923 Germany. And it had, so hyperinflation comes from when you print a bunch of money. Mm-hmm. And then after that money has been printed, then you get what they call velocity, which is people start to spend the money. Mm-hmm. In this economy, we've got the money that has been printed. And when I say money's been printed, I don't want to understate it. That America printed 25% of its total currency supply in 1 year, which is crazy. If you go back to George Washington up to Joe Biden, 25% had been printed last year. So crazy numbers. And what Michael Burry's saying is once the velocity comes back, that will turn into hyperinflation. And all the conditions are there for hyperinflation. And those conditions are things like the M2 money supply has gone vertical. Mm-hmm. Everyone is speculating if it's not Bitcoin, it's GameStop, it's all this sort of stuff. So people are looking for ways to get into alternatives to the currency. Mm-hmm. And because interest rates are zero, there's in a sense no risk not to do it. Mm-hmm. There's no like, I mean, you could lose your money, but besides that, if everything's going up, the risk of missing out is greater than the risk of being wrong. Mm-hmm. So all the conditions are there for hyperinflation that Michael Burry talks about.
Yeah, I had a few things. I was looking at what happened during the Weimar inflation period. So Weimar inflation sort of went on for 10 years, right? And one of the biggest thing was basically a lot of speculation. So things like what you just mentioned before, GameStop. Last year it was Hertz. And on top of that, the ratio between the rich and the poor was at its all-time high, which is what we are seeing currently as well in the markets if we watch it closely. And also, one of the big things at the time when hyperinflation finally did hit was likes of Berlin Stock Exchange, they were running behind on the volumes, the amount of volume that they were getting on stock trading, all the trading activities and all. And he hashtagged Robin Hood as an example for that, because obviously Robinhood did went down with what happened with a GameStop. So that was the other one.
Yep.
On top of that is the hyperinflation, obviously, in Germany lasted for 9 years. And if you were to compare that to the Western world, or US more specifically, the money supply started increasing exponentially or at a decent pace since 2008 GFC. So since 2008, it's already been, you can say, more than 10 years now that we are at a point where it's getting very super close to hyperinflation. So speculation, ratio of rich versus poor, volumes of trading due to these stimulus checks going crazy. And then obviously the period for how long the fresh money has been now manipulated or printed into the system. It's already been 10 years. And then plus on top of that is the reflation, which is what we were talking about before, oil prices going up, reflation trade, and a lot of stimulus, which will lead to more and more inflation, AKA hyperinflation. I think together, when you combine all those, Michael Burry's article makes perfect sense, him coming out and talking about hyperinflation And we did discuss that as well last year on this podcast. It's more, how do you spot whether we are close to it or not? And I think based on what happened during the Weimar period, and we have just said, listed those things, I think it feels that way. Now, whether it will happen today or whether it will still take another 10 years, nobody knows. But when there's this much activity in the stock markets and the prices of the stocks go up without taking into account what the actually companies, PEs, and all the other, what the balance sheets are.
Well, the money printing, so the conditions are set for a hyperinflation, but we don't have hyperinflation. So so the way I kind of look at it is, if you're in the forest and you've got the money printing is like putting all the dry twigs and the leaves and all that sort of stuff in a pile, but that's not going to create a bushfire without a flame. So you still need a trigger. You still need a flame. And that flame is usually when velocity returns. So something that has to happen. So at the moment, you can't have a hyperinflation because they've printed all this money, but the deflationary forces are, there's lots of unemployment, there's lots of fear, people are saving money, so savings rates are very high.
Mm-hmm.
Once those savings rates get deployed into assets and goods and all that sort of stuff, that'll turn into hyperinflation. It's very hard to suck the money back in without creating a recession for the central banks.
Exactly. David, welcome back. Oh, welcome to the show, not back. Welcome to
the show. Thanks, guys. Look, I'm just here to listen. I think this topic is obviously very, very macroeconomic side of things. So it's way beyond my pay grade. Let's put it that way. I'm being as a student here today to learn.
Yeah, so I am with you, John, on pretty much everything we said. Looking at those kind of indicators that we discussed before. And
sorry, I've rudely interrupted. There's one other thing that the Michael Burry tweet. So he wrote the article and he had the tweet, but the tweet was taken down. So the tweet has been deleted, as it feeds into something else that we've chatted about a lot, which is censorship. Like, this is, we're in the era of censorship. So he should be able to say that this kind of monetary policy is all a bit upside down. But if you say it, you'll get taken, you know, these tweets get taken down. So that's the other interesting thing that we've chatted about a bit before.
Yeah. And just for the listeners who don't know who Michael Burry is, Michael Burry was the famous guy during the subprime crisis who predicted the housing bubble at the time and was the first person to short it. And I think he made at the time roughly about 100 million from that shorting. That's the money that went into his pocket. The investment firm obviously did made a lot more money. And there's actually a movie on that guy as well, or the whole subprime crisis, 2008 crisis, The Big Short.
Movie, by the way.
Great movie. It's very, very relevant to the current environment.
Absolutely.
Just on that movie that and on his character in particular, there's a very subtle message in there as well about patience and about sticking to your convictions. So he wanted to short the housing market, but there was actually no product to do that. No one had tried to do this before. So he had to go to the big banks like Goldman Sachs and create a product where none existed. And then during the movie, he would go up to the whiteboard and write the gains or losses from that trade. And every kind of 10 minutes, he'd write negative 16%, and then it would be negative 25%. So he was losing money on this trade that he had a lot of conviction for, and he knew he was right. But the market was, in his view at least, irrational until it caught up with him. And the final scene of the movie is where he walks up to that whiteboard, wipes out minus 35% and writes plus 116%. Mm-hmm. So he was wrong until he was right. And I think for people who are sort of placing these bets and they've done their research and they know they're right, you know, stick, if you've got the conviction, stick with it, because markets are wrong until they're right again. And it's a good lesson, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a really good point actually that you made over there. It's the conviction and the homework that he did, and he was the only guy. And especially when you're the standing against the herd, it's always hard. It's easy to stand with a crowd. It's super hard to stand by yourself alone, especially when it's investors' money. So, hats off. And also, just for your FYI, David, he's trying to short Tesla as well. So just be careful.
Fair enough, mate. Fair enough. Look, I'm a long-term holder in that sense. If it goes down, I'm happy to buy more. In fact, this week I've been monitoring the price like a hawk. So try to pick up some bargain prices at the moment. But yeah, it's still not low enough. So you know what? Like, I actually every day, even morning, if I see it goes up, I'm actually not happy. I'm actually happy when it goes down because I'm like, great, it's time to pick up more, mate.
That's it. That's the way.
Where is he on Bitcoin? Does anyone know where he's on Bitcoin?
I think he's bullish gold and Bitcoin.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah. Typical hyperinflation scenario. If it is hyperinflation, the two assets, well, if Bitcoin is an asset, currently more of a speculative asset, if it is an asset, then he's called on both gold and Bitcoin to be the runners. Anything else, David, John, that you guys want to cover for the week?
Is it worthwhile talking about, I guess, Reddit try to do another round two of GameStop?
I didn't follow that news close enough, but if you guys know and can talk about it, let's go.
I don't know much about it, but yesterday I'm seeing the mega threads coming back up again, and people are trying to obviously push the prices up. And, you know, you get to see this warning message from trading platform to say there's going to be huge volatility with GameStop. So please be careful about investing and all that kind of stuff. So I don't know. I haven't looked at it close enough, but I have a feeling that this time, obviously, the crowd is trying to do their magic again, just like last time, try to push it up even higher. I think last time they peaked at about $400. Mm-hmm. Per share from what, literally 50 cents, something like that. Mm-hmm. And now they're obviously aiming for even bigger this time. But I mean, funny enough, I don't know whether they, I don't know whether they will succeed. I think looking at the prices this morning, I think it's still hovered around the $100 mark at the moment for GameStop. It actually, last night, which is US's 25th, it was around 150, so it actually dropped. But yesterday, share market's all in the red anyway. So, but yeah, funny enough, no, I haven't followed enough, so I don't know. I don't think I can give too much update this time, but certainly it was an interesting topic that I thought was worth throwing out.
I have seen few headlines floating around, but I haven't digged into it. Maybe we will cover that up in more detail next week.
Yeah, I'd say so. Mm.
Along with Silver Squeeze, if there's more happening in that space too. We've been waiting anyway to see what happens.
The only thing I'd say is next week we'll talk about, so it'll be February and would be into March by then. I think there are going to be some staggering real estate figures next week. So I saw some mid-month figures and the numbers were big. So the growth is very, very high. By the end of the month, I'm expecting a lot of revisions, a lot of speculation about bubbles and all that sort of stuff. So the real estate numbers are going to be very interesting next week, and I look forward to chatting about that.
Interesting that you mentioned real estate. One of the things that we were discussing before the recording and I forgot to mention over the pod is speaking to some of the local agents within the area, right, talking about outer suburbs more, there's two trends that we are seeing. One is completely new to me, where the demand for rents and the purchasing is high at the same time. And the second is landlords in the inner ring area who own the apartments and all, they're actually handing over vouchers, whether it's a week's rent or month's rent, whatever that is, to fetch more or to get their properties basically leased, essentially. What are your thoughts in general on the demand for both rents and the sales being high at the same time? Maybe start with David. David, what do you reckon?
The sales price and, I mean, the sales price and rent are both going up because there's still that demand for lifestyle type of assets. So that's why we're seeing like middle to outer ring, especially houses. I don't think units are fetching as much as that would be, right? So we're talking about like a two-speed economy again here. You know, you're talking about the units which is running at their own speed, and I think they're starting to pick up slowly as well in terms of prices, not the rent. The rent is definitely dropping as people are now seeking for more spaces, which is why they're looking at houses. that kind of stuff. So for those people who can afford to purchase a house and not being outbid, of course, that's why, you know, there's a lot of demand in that. Mm-hmm. But for those people who's constantly outbid and at one point in time they say, that's it, I had enough, I'm just going to rent, but I'm going to rent a house.
Mm-hmm.
So again, there's also that demand as well. So, you know, that's the type of two buyers that I'm seeing at the moment in the market. And that's why they're both, you know, either way, they all want to go after houses with some kind of lifestyle, you know, still hopefully not too far from transport, so that in case that they do need to go into commute to city one day or 2 days a week, that can be easily achieved. So that's why we're seeing this. That's the way how I read it and interpreted in terms of how it is. Because I can tell you at the moment, yes, the Eastern Seaboard is going frantic. The same thing with Western Seaboard of Perth as well. You know, I think I caught up with David Hall the other day and he was saying good houses are flying out literally within hours being put on the market.
Yeah, exactly the same thing, David, over here. When you speak to the locals, properties are just selling like hotcakes and there's queues outside the property. I think it's more the reason they both, and this is my guess, right? Mm-hmm. And it's a very educated guess, is the reason both rents and the prices or the sales transactions are, or volumes are being so high is purely because people are flocking. This clearly tells you that people are flocking out of the CBD areas, right? Ones who can afford to purchase are making the purchase. Others who were renting or prefer to rent are looking for the rents. And hence, the outer areas are getting that much of traffic from these new fresh set of buyers who in the past used to prefer to live near the CBD areas. Now with the COVID lockdown and the work from home, they've learned, you know what, there's a better lifestyle that's available. A little bit more stress-free kind of thing. So, John.
So I agree with everything David said, and you, Jazz. The only thing I'd add is that the prices, the movement for the house and unit prices is very macro, and that is to say that everything's going up everywhere. So regional, capital cities, Eastern Seaboard, Western Seaboard. So prices are going up everywhere. Rents are a bit different. So if prices are macro, rents are micro. I think that the rents that you've seen in your conversations are very specific to those areas. And what I think is when we see rental data come through, we'll still see rents going down, because if you blend the rents across all of the parts of the city, I think you'll find that rents are still going down, or at least flattening out. So that's the only thing I'd say, but it's extremely macro right now. Everything's going up. And we talk about units. Like last year, units were doing okay, but they weren't going up. But this year, units are hot too. So it's a hot market.
Awesome. Yeah. Great two topics for the day, gents. How to spot a bubble and Michael Burry talking about Weimar inflation. Every time this guy comes out and says something, you just have to watch the news carefully, read it. Obviously, he's proved himself few times, and with GameStop as well. So watch the space, and we'll try and bring more content next week for the listeners. Fly safe, stay safe, happy weekend, and we'll see you guys next Friday. David, John, Jazz.